Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme, climate change. Specifically looking at something that is never discussed in the mainstream media, the tipping points. And the failure of the United States and virtually all other major developed nations in addressing its full impact and threats to human existence. In essence, why are none of the nations from Germany and China that are advancing new solar technologies being completely honest? Why are we not having a Marshall Plan, that which helped after World War II rebuild Germany and Italy and Japan? Why aren't we using these energies, these resources, to address these issues? Joining us from Belize is Professor Guy McPherson. Guy is Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources, Ecology, and Evolutionary Biology, University of Arizona. He is specialized in forest resources, energy decline, and climate change and its economic consequences. In the past, he was also on the faculty at Texas A&M University, University of California, Berkeley. He is a person who is very outspoken. He is a person who does not believe that we gain anything from anything less than 100% truth. He has authored several books, the latest co-written with Carolyn Baker entitled Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. He is also the co-host of the radio program Nature Bats Last, heard every Tuesday evening at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Commentary Hour, Progressive Radio Network. His website is guymcpherson.com. Nice to have you with us today, Guy.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure to be with you, as always.
Guy, I would like to begin by you giving us a very comprehensive review of each of the major tipping points and how this impacts climate change. Now, these would be the tipping points that climatology scientists have reached at least as a consensus. If in the points that you speak on, where is the planet right now? How close or far from tipping? And what would be the likely predictable outcome when that point is reached? Also, since most people don't understand the environment, most people don't live immediately in a tipping point zone or where there's a catastrophic event that has occurred, then they're not as likely to be concerned. So in this discussion, you might give us examples of where we think we're safe. You know, if you're living in many parts of America, if you've never seen a tornado or a sandstorm, or if you haven't seen scorching earth where you can't plant anything because it's too hot, or the high mountains where the forests are decimated, or maybe live down in Louisiana or other places that have been hit with hurricanes, you may not fully appreciate how much of an impact these will have. And then we have the mainstream media, the science reporter for the mainstream media, who always seem to let half the truth out of every equation. And even our national agencies, our governors, our mayors, our presidents, they always want to say, there are problems, but we have time. So on the one hand, behind all of this you're going to tell us is the idea of, well, why do I care? By the time we get to that point where New York City's lower Manhattan has got water in the subways, we'll all be dead. No one born today will really have to worry about not living in Miami. So this is all kind of scare tactics by extremists. That is the approach people are taking. As a result, where people say climate change is important, they simply don't feel that they have to do anything about it because the clock hasn't reached a critical point. So include that into your discussions. And finally, in these discussions, which options does humanity have to either remedy the problem or lessen its outcome, or is it impossible at this stage of the game to change what is likely to happen with some of these tipping points? Take your time, please. The forum is yours.
Thank you, Gary. That's a great series of questions. I will undoubtedly fail to answer some of them, so be sure to keep me back on track or get me back on track if I wander astray. I'm going to quote largely from an essay I posted at GuyMacPherson.com, Nature Best Last, on August 1st, 2016. It was that analysis called The Politics and Science of Demise that led me to no longer update my often updated monster climate change essay. It's called Climate Change Summary Update. And I had been updating it every 2 or 3 days for several years. And finally, this analysis that I conducted in early August of this year convinced me that so many tipping points have been crossed, that so many self-reinforcing feedback loops triggered, that I would be astonished if there were complex life on this planet in 2030. And by complex life, I mean large multicellular organisms such as ourselves. Now, I started this essay by pointing that no mainstream scientist could talk near-term human extinction as a result of climate change and remain supported in his or her job. Therefore, none do. None go the distance in connecting the dots regarding our imminent demise. So, in the university system, paradoxically, we have tenure which is designed to protect academic freedom. I know of at least 4 major universities which censorship has led to faculty leaving the institutions. The University of Arizona, where I was, Ohio State University, where Jason Box left to move to Europe, the University of Texas, where Camille Parmesan left to go to Europe, Copenhagen in the case of Jason Box, and England, London in the case of Camille Parmesan. And finally, Peter Wadhams, who conducted 50 expeditions on and under the Arctic ice over the last couple of decades, was essentially squeezed out of Cambridge University and went to a university in Ireland. So we have this paradoxical system, universities where administrators walk a tightrope, promoting the dominant paradigm that we can keep destroying the planet forever with no adverse consequences in the name of money, while simultaneously paying lip service to academic freedom and occasionally academic freedom in the form of freedom of expression has to be sacrificed. So in this essay, I move on to write about some of the tipping points that have already been fired that guarantee a certain outcome by 10 years from July or August, first when the essay was posted. And they include, for example, the already experiencing on planet Earth of about 1.5 Celsius above baseline. I include 1.4. I base analysis on Sam Corana's analysis. Now, that's an interesting case right there, because Sam Corana is a name for a person or people who apparently want to remain under the radar of perhaps the people they work for. And so the analysis that Corana conducts is really quite good. I use it as a basis and check Corana's analysis against the refereed journal literature. And regardless of who takes the most conservative approach, Corana or the journal literature, I take the most conservative approach. For example, Corana concludes that we have increased global average temperature 1.92 degrees Celsius since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Guy, let me just interrupt you for a moment. For the audience, you're hearing a difficult audio feed because he's in Belize, and also there seems to be a dog there. Would you be able to please put the dog in the other room just to take a moment, or is that possible? Because the dog's barking is coming through. Unfortunately,
I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Sorry for the poor audio, and also for the not one dog, but four. And I've asked them to shut up for the moment. We'll see how long that lasts. Sorry for the audio problems here. Moving on, Koranic was 1.92 degrees Celsius above where we were at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in 1750, as of today, or when he wrote this, say, in mid-July of this year. And the consensus seems to be about 1.5 degrees Celsius so far above baseline at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So I take that 1.5 degrees. Now, this, despite the fact that the Record Journal literature indicates that we probably have missed, through our direct observations, about 19% of the global temperature rise within the last century or so. So it's pretty clear the Record Journal literature is very, very conservative. And I'm going to stick with that very conservative approach throughout this analysis, in part because I don't want to come across as somebody who's crying fire in a theater, even though I believe the theater is on fire. I don't want to come across as an extremist. I want to take the most conservative possible approach. So let's assume that we're at 1.5 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline so far. And then, because there is a 10-year lag between the release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and the maximum heating associated with that carbon dioxide, that's going to add a guaranteed another 0.5 degree Celsius in a decade to the current temperature of the Earth. It doesn't matter what we do at this point in terms of reducing or eliminating carbon dioxide emissions. The maximum heating associated with carbon dioxide occurs 10 years after emission. So you add that to the 1.5 degrees that we have locked into the system so far that we've already experienced, and we're at 2, which sort of makes a mockery of a 2-degree political target, much less 1.5-degree political target, which is already behind us. That was the target identified at a Paris meetings. Let's move on to some of the other impacts. Removal of what's called the aerosol masking effect, or global dimming, adds an additional 2.5 degrees C according to Koran, and 3 degrees C according to the Freedom literature. And that aerosol masking effect, or global dimming, results from particulates, most notably sulfates, that are put into the atmosphere as a result of industrial activity. So at the same time, our industrial activity through burning internal combustion engines and running coal-fired power plants and so on, at the same time that we're adding greenhouse gases, which act as blankets to hold the heat close to Earth, at the same time that's happening, we're also putting up aerosol masks, most notably sulfates and other particulates that reflect incoming sunlight back out into space. And when we remove all of those, then in a very short period of time, temperature that goes up quite catastrophically, about 3 degrees C, a very conservative literature, 2.5 according to Corana. So I'll go with that 2.5 degrees. That's baked in. That's guaranteed. And it's guaranteed not only because every civilization fails, but because this particular version of civilization, industrial civilization, teeters on the brink right now due to the inability to grow grains at scale. That's a characteristic of every civilization so far, is the ability to grow grains, to store food, to get through the hard times, the dry times, and the cold times. And we are right now hovering on the brink of inability to grow grains, because the grains are primarily on Earth in the interior of large continents in the northern hemisphere, places like the Midwestern United States, the Great Plains, for example, and Russia. Well, those places heat up at least twice as fast as the global average. So what that means is we've baked in 2 degrees for over the next 10 years minimum, and at the same time, we've baked in at least 4 degrees Celsius above baseline in the interior of large continents. Well, that's going to be catastrophic for grain production. Already, the ability to grow wheat and corn teeters on the brink as a result of climate change is underway. Let's tack on albedo changes in the Arctic. According to an analysis by Peter Wadhams in 2012, the energy absorption right now is about 0.75 watt per square meter. It's been that way since the early 1990s. Before that, it was about 0.43 watts per square meter over the planet. And Wadhams in his analysis concludes that over the course of the next 10 years, we're going to see an ice-free Arctic that is going to increase the global average temperature by a little over 1.5 degrees Celsius within the next 10 years. That's because that extra energy is not going to be reflected by the ice in what is essentially an ice-free Arctic right now. By the way, we can remove any one of these. All of these are based on conservative analyses. But I get a lot of pushback from people. When we add these up, it takes us to a really high number. So if you have an issue with Peter Wan's analysis, and I haven't seen anybody who has argued with the analysis, only with the person or the outlet that the analysis has appeared in. So if you don't like part of this analysis, I would say it's not really necessary to include that part. We won't maybe reach 8.5 degrees Celsius above baseline, which is where we're headed and appears that we're locked in, if you take out one or two of these numbers. But I still don't see any way that complex organisms survives a very rapid increase in global temperature in a short period of time. Consider, for example, C4 methane from the Arctic Ocean. According to Karana's analysis, only at 1.1 degrees Celsius between now and 2026. Well, Natalia Shkova and colleagues concluded that we can expect a 50 gigaton burst of methane to be highly possible at any time. This is based on a paper they delivered at the 2008 European Geophysical Union meetings. In 2015, Shkova came out in an interview and said, we never stated that there would be a release of methane abruptly or over any particular period of time. But if you go back to the European Geophysical Union meeting archives, you can see that right in the archives, she did exactly that. Her and her colleagues concluded that we could expect a 50 gigaton burst of methane to be highly possible at any time. And they concluded that that would cause an increase in global average temperature about 1.3 degrees Celsius. That's from the first 50 gigaton burst of methane. Now, Paul Beckwith, who I know you've been interviewing on this station, concludes that we could experience at least 5 degrees Celsius global average temperature rise due to methane release from beneath the shallow seafloor of the Arctic Ocean. So using that 1.1 degree number seems really low to me. If you follow the work of David Archer at the University of Chicago, or Gavin Schmidt with the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, you might conclude that C4 methane is nothing to worry about over the next 10 years or even over the course of the next 100 years. So I say, okay, if you really believe that's not a problem, based on research by modelers who are stunned that the data don't adhere to the models instead of the other way around, then throw out that 1.1 degrees and we're still headed for a disaster. Another self-reinforcing feedback loop is moistening of the upper troposphere. Most of the water vapor around the planet is stored in the upper troposphere, and water vapor is the most abundant and most rapidly acting greenhouse gas. So we add a little bit of humidity to the atmosphere. What that does is that acts as a lens to further heat up the planet. Further heating the planet causes more moisture to accumulate in the upper troposphere. As it gets hotter, it gets moister. The atmosphere is able to hold more moisture when hot than when it's cold. And so Karana adds a little over 2 degrees Celsius for the extra water vapor feedback. I think that of the approximately 1.5 degree global average temperature rise so far, roughly half is due to moistening the atmosphere and the other half is due to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And I conclude the equilibrium point between moistening the upper troposphere and global average temperature of the Earth, that equilibrium is reached within a matter of days or weeks, not over a very long period of time. And so I conclude that roughly half of the existing 1.5 degrees or so above baseline is a result of moistening the upper troposphere. Finally, Karina adds 0.3 degrees for other feedbacks, and I've documented more than 5 dozen other self-frequencing feedback loops besides the ones we've talked about so far, including, for example, methane release from the permafrost in Canada, Alaska, and Russia. And so I think that 0.3 degrees C over the course of the next decade is a stunningly conservative number, and so I use it in my analysis. And as a consequence, I end up with only a little over an 8 degree Celsius global average temperature rise by mid-2026. It takes us very close to the temperature the planet has experienced most frequently, most often, over the course of the last 2 billion years, which is about 22 degrees Celsius global average temperature. So in general, over the course of the last 2 billion years, the planet has spent quite a bit of time in ice age, or 12 degrees Celsius global average temperature, and most of the time, by far the most amount of time, at 22 degrees Celsius, or what I call hothouse. There was a time or two in the last 2 billion years that the temperature rose to 23 degrees Celsius global average temperature, most notably during the Great Dying of 252 million years ago, when the temperature went from ice age, or 12 degrees Celsius, to hothouse and beyond, 23 degrees Celsius, over a span of somewhere between 800 years and 20,000 years or so. Well, this time we're talking about a similar rise in temperature over a span of two pulses, one coming out of the Holocene and the pulse that's to come. That'll be the most rapid global average temperature that I'm familiar with from the literature, and that I think is probably far and away the most rapid. So the Great Dying 250 million years ago wiped out nearly all complex life on Earth, and it took place over a span of several hundred to maybe a couple of tens of thousands of years. And to conclude that humans will survive a similar rise in temperature in only a couple hundred years, much less over the course of the next decade, which is when the vast majority of the heating will occur, is exceedingly optimistic, it seems to me, and that we depend upon so many other species for our survival. So I want to stop right there and give you a chance to put you back on track and maybe point us towards some of the media, some of the governmental responses or lack of response, or maybe follow up on the science, as the case may be.
If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson. He's in Belize. As a result, even with Skype or the hardline, we are having some audio limitations, so please accept that the information he is sharing is spot on and essential, so we are accepting the audio limitations because of the quality of what he's saying. Now, Guy, if I understand what you're saying that because of multiple feedback loops, including the Arctic melting and the sea rises, and the extreme heat differentiation around the world compared to what it was, that within 10 years from now, 10 years, we will start entering a new age of extinction. We're already in that era of extinction of many species. I think it's 200 species a day are going extinct on the planet. And because we have done nothing, and when I say nothing, I mean we have done absolutely positively nothing as individuals or major governments to address such things as, what do we do with the plastic, you know, that ends up in the oceans? What have we done with the acidification of the water, which creates a deadening of the sea life because certain sea plants as well as certain fish and mammals cannot live if it gets too hot in the ocean? We've seen billions of fish die, in the last couple of years. Remarkable fish kill-offs. And yet it comes in the news and it's gone, and we never ask why. And yet we still assume that, oh, we can still have a diet that contains fish. And yet that is not going to be the case. We also see that we're having torrential rain, flooding and extreme levels, like just now in Louisiana. And what was remarkable about Louisiana is that most people did not have flood insurance because it had never flooded in most of Louisiana. Now, near the Gulf, yes, there had been flooding, but not inland. And the majority of the counties, what they call parishes in Louisiana, one had 85,000 homes destroyed. That's in one single parish. There's a lot of parishes in Louisiana. And where the homes were so wrecked with rain that now they don't have insurance. And that hasn't even been factored in. What do you do with a home you can't live in because the building will not be given permits if they can't do it properly, and black mold is growing prolifically in all these people's homes. So there's a national disaster that has happened, but the side effects, all these people having to live somewhere, no money to rebuild their homes, not that they should even consider in these places, because it's not going to be the last time it happens. And yet that was one of these remarkable 500-year events, and we've had seven 500-year events in the last year. We've also had flooding in places that historically have never flooded. And then we have drought upstate New York. In fact, almost all of upstate New York, half the counties in New York, are now in severe drought. You wouldn't imagine that. You'd think mountains and the Adirondacks and the Walk Hill Reserve and all, but it's still, there's a whole lot of damage, because with this drought now comes the beetles that are infecting the trees that don't have the water. That's causing fires. 36,000 fires in the United States in the last 12 months. That's 36,000 major fires. And that is going to be the new norm. We had the largest sandstorm. We had the largest tornado. We had the most earthquakes in Oklahoma, the most earthquakes in Kansas, and that are attributed to hydrofracking. And yet we're not doing a single thing to stop hydrofracking. We're not doing anything to get off oil. We're not doing anything to clean up the byproduct of pollution from the military-industrial complex. The largest polluter in America is the U.S. military. It's exempt for all pollution rules. So we have an ocean that's overheating, water that's polluted, running out of groundwater. The largest aquifer in America, the Alagalaga, that covers seven states, is 50% gone, and some of the states bordering it can't pull out the water. So the great breadbasket of America not only is heating up, as you said, which is going to mean the grains like corn, you said, and soy will not be able to be grown. In fact, right now in the United States, we're finding, because of mismanagement of a mono agriculture, one single crop per year over and over and over again, and helping the soil only with artificial fertilizers, high nitrogen fertilizers, which go into the rivers, the Mississippi River, the Missouri River, end up in the Gulf of Mexico, killing all life, having dead zones the size of New Jersey, and now there are dozens of these giant dead zones where there's no oxygen, so those species that require oxygen can't live there. So now that's another factor. We also have the conveyor belt of the ocean that takes warm water up, brings cool water down. That's slowing down, and if that stops, which is possible, then we end up having a major change in the environment on the entire Western European area from Ireland, Scotland, England, France, Germany, clear down. They're going to be devastated. And we haven't even touched upon the impact of drought to 600 million people in Africa and the Middle East, who will then have no place to go, no money to get there, no food, no water. They're out of water in Jordan. They're out of water in Egypt. Egypt has no water on its own. It has to rely upon water that's allowed to go through other countries to get to it. You have countries like Saudi Arabia with no water, and yet they're not doing a single thing to change that. So when I'm looking at the crisis we're in, and then you use your figures, that is also a very conservative figure, you're going to the very ultra-conservative, you're not being liberal, you're not being 100% worst-case scenario, you're being pulled back from the worst-case scenario, you're saying we've got 10 years until these common events, what were 123,000 extreme weather events around the world in the last 12 months, that will be the new norm, and that'll be simple. That means that at least 2 billion people end up starving to death. There's now 1.3 billion who are food insecure. It means at least 600 million people will have to move from where they're at, and there's no place to put them, no food to give them, and no way of getting them there. And we see the damage and danger that happens when we have 7 million displaced people who at least have some money, educations, and a way of getting from Libya, Syria, and Yemen into Greece, Germany, and other countries. And so where are we supposed to put all these people? How are we supposed to feed them? How are we supposed to feed Americans? Yet the average American has the advantage of being able to pull food supplies from around the world. So if you're hungry today and you live in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, all of our major cities, you go to a market and there is 3,000 varieties of food. There are places in this world today where there are food riots because they don't have any food. And yet the day will come in the near future, unless you're very wealthy and can spare a lot of money, you're not going to be able to buy the variety of food or necessarily the quality of food. So we're going to see possibly water wars in the United States, legal battles, and food outbreaks where people who are poor and hungry could riot. And therefore, we're beginning right now. We are in the next major change. And most Americans, probably 99% of Americans, are either intentionally ignorant of the subject. It overwhelms them. They do not comprehend how to deal with it, so they simply avoid it, deny it, and go back to watching reality television or sports. The politicians are not honest. Most of the environmental groups get money, huge amounts of money, frequently from very polluting industries, and therefore they're not really addressing in any concrete way. And all these absolutely asinine, and I'm calling it out as asinine, environmental conferences that do absolutely positively nothing except get media FaceTime for those people who want to brag about going to Paris or somewhere else and showing up saying, look what we're doing about the environment. And I'm saying, you may be there to do something, but the governments are not doing anything. And so therefore, we're lucky to be alive 15 years from now, most of the people. Am I accurate, inaccurate? Show me what my perspective is compared to yours.
Yeah, I think you're done. In fact, I think it's worse than what you're suggesting even, because rapid rise in temperature that is locked in, there is no known technology to prevent such a rapid rise in temperature. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in their latest assessment, implies that large-scale carbon capture will be used, but we don't have any technology to do that. So we just keep going along, doing nothing, and point out. And in fact, it was research that was completed in 2007, published initially in 2009 by Tim Garrett at the University of Utah, published in the prestigious journal Climate Action, that concluded that only collapsed civilization prevents runaway climate change. Well, now it's pretty apparent that collapsed civilization, due to the lack of global dimming or the aerosol masking effect, triggers runaway climate change. So we're truly in this worst-case situation of being in the early stages of abrupt climate change or runaway climate change. And the only, quote, solution that's been offered is to collapse civilization. Well, of course, very few people are going to vote for that. No politicians are going to remain in office if they even mention the idea, much less try to implement policies that collapse civilization. And I actually corresponded with Tim Garrett, with Dr. Garrett, about what he meant, because I got so much resistance to the idea when I was interpreting what he was writing. So I asked him, what do you mean? And he says, it means what it sounds like it means. It collapses civilization means no food at the grocery stores, no fuel at the filling stations, no water coming to the municipal taps. Well, you know, no politician is going to put that on there as the major plank in their platform to prevent runaway climate change. And now we know a lot more than we did when Garrett's paper came out in 2009. Based on papers by James Hansen and colleagues in late 2011, and then subsequent papers up through 2013, we now know that the aerosol masking effect adds an additional about 3 degrees Celsius when civilization collapses. So we're in runaway right now, and to make it is to collapse civilization, the only thing that, according to the Referee General literature, prevent runaway climate change. So we're truly in this worst-case scenario of being damned if you do and damned if you don't. There appears, short of unicorns and multicolored flies and all kinds of animals that we might pull out of the hat, it appears that there is no way to stop events that are already underway and that will transpire over the course of the next 10 years. And so what that means is I see no way for complex organisms such as humans to survive long beyond the point at which we're in the midst of the Great Dust Bowl, beyond the point at which, you know, 1.5 degrees, you talked about the huge fires are occurring that we have no means of controlling. We're at 1.5°C. I'm talking about getting to 8°C above baseline in the next decade. What's it going to look like at 4°C? I doubt there will be much life on the planet. I doubt there will be a tree on the planet because organisms just can't keep up with that rapid rate of change. That means we can't keep up either because we rely upon the other organisms for our own survival. If you don't think that's true, try to get through your day or your week and study what you eat and think about where it actually came from. Think about the ground it was grown in, or if it's higher on the food chain, think about the ground that supported the food, that created the food that you're eating, the meat, for example. So there's all kinds of difficulties, challenges, predicaments associated with getting from here to 8°, 6°, even 4°C Celsius above baseline, and having humans survive in the process of that transition. So nobody's working on any of that as near as I know, except for the occasional thought of going to Mars to escape the utter nest we've created here and hope that somehow we're going to change human behavior when we get to the next one and not destroy it as fast as we're destroying this one. It all seems so surreal to me.
Guy, in your opinion, are there one or two tipping points that we need to be most concerned about and which could trigger a cascade event for the others?
Yes, absolutely. There's the ice-free Arctic. An analysis by the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School several years ago concluded that the Arctic would be ice-free in 2016, that's this year, this September, plus or minus 3 years. And that didn't happen this year, and it didn't happen the previous 3 years. I think we've dodged a bullet 4 years in a row. But the ice that is in the Arctic right now is incredibly thin and is quite susceptible to being broken up with a large storm or two. So going into next year's freeze period, which is starting approximately now, and then ending that freeze period and getting to the melt period next summer, I think we're on, quote, very thin ice. And Peter Williams has a recent book out about this very topic. So I think that's absolutely huge. We haven't had an ice-free Arctic in the history of humans on the planet. It's been millions of years since we've had an ice-free Arctic, about 200,000 years since Homo sapiens arrived on the planet. So I think the very rapid warming guaranteed by the loss of a little bit of ice is going to trigger a rapid rise in temperature the likes of which we've never seen on this planet. The notion of latent heat, if you haven't been familiar with the notion of latent heat, then I would encourage you to do a little research on it. What I'm talking about here is, here's the analogy I sometimes use. You're at a party, you have a glass half full with your favorite beverage, half full with ice, and 2 hours later, the temperature of the beverage is still freezing. It's still 0°C Celsius because there's a little bit of ice left in the glass. But as soon as the last little bit of ice melts, the beverage glass reaches room temperature because your warm hand is holding it and you're walking around and there's no ice to keep it cool, reaches warm a warm room temperature in a matter of minutes. So my last 2 or 2.5 hours at 0 degrees Celsius. And then, as soon as the last bit of ice has melted, it very, very rapidly warms. Well, that's the situation we're facing in the Arctic when the Arctic becomes ice-free within the next year or 2 years or 3 years, however long it takes. It's not going to be a long time. And that will cause, because of latent heat, an abrupt warming of the planet, and also because of release of subsea methane from beneath the relatively shallow Arctic Ocean. Already, we are observing exponential rise in methane in the atmosphere since 1950, and most notably since 2007. So atmospheric methane is up more than 200% since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, as compared to carbon dioxide being up a little over 40% in that period of time. So the loss of albedo, the absorption of energy from the sun when the Arctic loses all the ice, is absolutely huge and is being largely ignored by the mainstream media and by the governments of the world.
Okay.
The next really important issue for me is methane coming out of the Arctic Ocean. Those two obviously are connected. So those are both just absolutely huge factors that have been largely ignored so far. I can talk about others, or we might want to go a different direction.
Well, when you consider the methane coming up from the Arctic, the argument is by the time the methane reaches the surface or close to it, it is substantially dissipated. Okay, let's just say they're right. Now, what about the methane coming from the boreal forests? What about the methane coming from those historically frozen areas, larger than the entire landmass of the United States, in Russia, in Canada? Canada's larger than the United States. And even parts of other countries that historically had frozen ground. Now there's nothing between that methane coming out and anything that can absorb it, because we've cut down the great Amazon rainforest by 20%, and we're not going to stop doing that because people in power want to exploit either for the lumber or for the soybeans that will grow where there were rainforests that were the lungs of the planet, absorbing the CO2. Now they're not there to do that. As a result, we have the desertification of the Amazon, something we've never had before. So when I'm looking at the problem, I observe that there is no concerted effort being made by any developed nation, as I mentioned at the beginning, and the United States in particular, for tackling the climate change threat head on. Even both the Democrat and Republican Party have no program that will fundamentally change climate change, because they're both beholden to the special interest groups, the major polluters, including the Coke industries. And once you take money from these corporations, once you have allowed them to help you in your fundraising, once you have allowed them to allow members of your corporation to go to governmental agencies in Washington and sit on boards, then you're compromised. You're not coming back. It's like you can't say to Tony Soprano, "Tony, I like the fact I was in the mob for a while, made some money. I'm going to retire now and take my secrets of my life with the mob with me." You don't retire from the mob. And you don't retire from having complicity in the association with major corporations and our completely corrupt United States government. So, when we are in collective denialism, including the entire left, they may talk about global warming, but as a movement, they do nothing. Individuals do, but we've been in a dishonest state of mind. Consequently, the public is not receiving honest information about the severity of climate change and how much it will completely disrupt our lives, our health, our resources, and our way of accustomed living in the future. And also, based upon human nature, we often not deal with primary causes behind catastrophes until it's simply too late. Our karma comes when we say, "I'm watching Katrina, I'm watching Sandy, isn't it fun being on the beach? Look there, there are high waves, let's go surfing." And then you lose your life, your home, or something else. Then we say, "Gee whiz, how dare that storm invade our living space?" Well, we'll rebuild in the same space. I'm seeing this collective denialism, and I see it all the time in disease. I just lost 9 close friends, 3 professional friends, 6 personal friends in the last 2 years, not because they were stupid or unaware, but because they simply did not want to go through the inconvenience of change. They would sit right there and talk about how important it is to be healthy and eat a hamburger. Or they'd talk about their concern for the environment, but then buy plastic or buy clothes they didn't need. So we have this, and my friends are no different than the average people, we have this idea that we want change, we want someone to save us from our maladaptive attempts at living, but we don't want to be the engine of that. And at the same time, our economy is collapsing. And for the average person, we have more people out of work than ever before in American history, including the Great Depression. We have over 102 million Americans who could work but can't. We have more disabilities in men between the ages of 25 and 45 than ever before in our history. We have more people on opiates for pain reduction than ever before. We have more children on psychiatric drugs, more babies on psychiatric drugs, more adolescent psychiatric drugs than ever before. There's not a single bit of science justifying it. We have a public health policy in the United States that has nothing to do with public health at all. There is nothing the Surgeon General, the U.S. Public Health Services, the CDC will do unless it is complicit with the hidden hand of the pharmaceutical industry and its agents in guiding our public health policy, like mass vaccination. Well, that's not what stops disease. You know, you can clean up the living conditions, get proper nutrition, and that stops disease. They're not willing to put money into there. So all of our federal agencies are completely corrupt, totally corrupt, screwed to the end of the earth is how corrupt the CDC is. And it's not a secret anymore. They're so powerful, they're so arrogant, they're so imbued with a determinist hubris, they don't have to even disguise their disdain for ethics, morality, and the truth. And at the same time, where there's about 5% of the American population, that's still about 17 million people, who want a safe world, want a sustainable world, want health, want to clean up the rivers, the streams, the lakes, protect that which we hold in common, their neighbors don't care. They don't care. Just make sure I get extra french fries. Did you give me 6 pieces of bacon on that triple hamburger? Did I get all I can eat? While the person's now, they'll probably have, the next step, Guy, will be restaurants where you go in and you get into a hospital bed and you have a nurse and a cardiologist there as you eat yourself into a heart attack. You'll pay $5 extra for it, but what the hell? And that's where we're at. In my opinion, now, I'm not being cynical. I'm merely being honest about what I see, where the people are not going to change, the government's not going to change, corporations not going to change, the media's too compromised to change or cowardly to change. It only leaves a small number of committed activists. So, if we're not going to move out of Miami, then the only case we have in point is we have to build $220 million worth of water pump turbines, state-of-the-art, that takes water from flooded Miami Beach. I lived there for 15 years, right, until 2 years ago when I sold it, because I saw the rise of the sea level at night with the tide coming up, so much so that I saw seaweed on the bottom of buildings, swimming pools, that I'd never seen before. And all those 100,000 homes from Key West up through the whole coast of the East Coast of the United States, those are all on sand. Concrete pilings, but sand. Sooner or later, the ocean takes it back, the buildings crack, they're no longer structurally feasible to live in, and then everything else goes with it. But I'll bet that you will have 99% of those people not wanting to move, not looking for another place to move, and then looking for someone to sue because the developer, the builder, someone sold them something and didn't give them a real warning. Why didn't you want to know? Well, you should have been more determined to tell me the truth. You should have held me against the wall and says, don't be stupid enough to buy in a place that's not sustainable. But you didn't tell me that, and I didn't want to know that. So I bought a stupid place because I'm a stupid person, and now I'm looking to be a victim, and when I am, I'm going to blame you for it. And hence we're into a blame culture, a victimization culture, without anyone seeing the irony of reason in the equation. Do you have a responsibility to see what you're doing? And if not, then what is the likely outcome at every level? So I see our problem with our environment. I see it in placed in our every institution, from higher education to our food to our public health policies. Everything is being painted with the same brush. of complicity. Those are my thoughts. Please challenge them, deconstruct them, and show me where I'm wrong.
No, of course you're not wrong. This is the nanny state, and the dependence upon the state that will take care of us so that we do not take personal responsibility. And, you know, in an entire culture where very few people are even willing to acknowledge that we have problems, much less predicaments, well, how are you going to get people in mass to change their lives? It's almost impossible. Let me give you an example of tipping points being passed. It was June 30th, 1989, that the Associated Press ran a story quoting Noel Brown, the head of the New York office of the United Nations Environment Program. On June 30th, 1989, according to this Associated Press story, Noel Brown said, "We have 10 years to solve the climate change problem, 10 years to turn this ship around." Well, that was more than 27 years ago, and we haven't done anything except make the whole situation worse. People didn't listen. It was in the Associated Press, so it ran in many, many, many newspapers around the country, around the world. We knew that there was a serious problem at that time. The governments didn't step in to do anything. The corporations didn't step in to do anything. The people didn't step up to do anything. And here we are, 27 years and change later, and the 10 years that we had to turn the ship around have long passed. And of course, we got to the point as early as 2007, probably before then, when Tim Geer concluded that civilization is a heat engine and the way to turn off the overheating is to turn the heat engine. And of course, almost nobody wants that. Nobody wants to be deprived of their car. Nobody wants to be deprived of their public transportation. Nobody wants to be deprived of the groceries at their favorite grocery store, organic or not. So, of course, as of 1989 or maybe before then, maybe a few years after then, we had reached the point of no return. This catastrophic rise in global average temperature was locked in at that point. And this fundamental reliance upon a state, and by state, I'm talking about nation states, and the corporations that are overwhelmingly influential in controlling the decisions of those states. So we have these states that have no particular interest in serving the people. We have a people who are so dependent on the nanny state that they're going to rise up or even ask politely for changes at scale. And so, of course, here we are. How could we expect anything different? Of course.
What can people do who really care and are not waiting to be encouraged, coerced, motivated into preparing for this?
For many years, I assumed, based on changes so far, that the last habitat for humans on Earth would be in the southern part of the southern hemisphere, places like Tasmania, the southern island state of Australia, and New Zealand, and southern South America, and South Africa. And that was many years ago. A guy named Steve Wozniak, single-handedly built the Apple I and Apple II computers, took my advice, corresponded with me, and moved to Tasmania, the southern island state of Australia, as a result of this information they've been putting out. And now I've reached this the conclusion subsequently is that none of us have long on the planet if we are complex organisms depending upon small organisms for our survival. And so as a result, I don't think there's a great deal of time to be gained by moving to New Zealand or Tasmania or Chile or whatever. And so my message has consequently changed somewhat to being not one of personal survival, much less societal survival, but instead being focused upon how we live today and how we live tomorrow and who we choose to spend time with and how we choose to treat those we are spending our time with. So, you know, even if we live to be 100 years old, that's still not a long time. And so let's let's act as if we don't have a law, because in fact we don't.
But Guy, you're telling us we're going to, Guy, you're telling us we're going to start to see the big extinction start in within 10 years. I'm an optimist. I'm one of those people
Absolutely.
Who believes that we don't give up, but I have to distinguish and differentiate the survival of all of society versus the survival of those who are motivated, caring, and sensitive enough to look what they can do. I'll give you one example. I looked all over the world for the best places to be. I found a place in the mountains in the United States, in a southern state that has abundant water forever, well, a trillion-gallon aquifer, quality land, plus the new innovations. In fact, I've just designed a new state-of-the-art hydroponic house for myself that gives 500% more yield, and doesn't matter what the temperature is outside. Looking at the most I could do as a human being to be 100% off the grid, but still have a quality of life, and then to invite those people that you care about to spend time. And I see that there'll be millions of Americans, my opinion, over the next 10 to 15 years, because of what will be happening, not just with the environment, but also the political scene, where you go into real fascism that we're going into, joining other people into smaller communities, diverse communities, where they have this consciousness and are willing to apply principles of conscious living, shared living, in a way that they will be able to sustain more than those people who are not going to look ahead at what is coming at them, don't want to see what's coming at them. And if you're on a cruise ship and you have a 400-foot wave coming at you, you can close the door, but it's not going to stop that's happening. And that's where most people are. They're on that Titanic and just distracting themselves. There's no preparation. There's no planning. There's nothing. Well, for those of us who care, there is planning. We've been planning this, working on this. So I might be more optimistic than you are at this point, and will continue to be so, because I believe that there is going to be a future. It's just not going to be a future that everyone will be a part of because of their lack of commitment and interest in the very topic. But I'm glad you're out there. We're out of time. And down in Belize, a beautiful country, by the way, great human beings.
Well, yeah, I just want to make a final point. I have never proposed inaction, and I walked away from American imperialism 7 years ago and left a high-pay, low-work job to do exactly what you're talking about, to live off-grid, create a community of my own, and so on. So I've never promoted inaction. I am completely with you on taking action. I'm just beyond the point of thinking that that's going to save our species. I'm not, absolutely not, giving up on action, and I certainly encourage your optimism, and I encourage your action by everybody who is interested in a future of some kind for themselves and those they love.
Good. Well, Guy, thank you very much, and we look forward to our next discussion. Guy McPherson in Belize.
Sorry, thank you, Gary.
Sorry for the poor technical quality on the audio, but there's nothing we can do because of that's the technology we're able to use. His website is guymcpherson.com. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm Gary Knoll. Don't go anywhere. We have another hour coming. Talk Back, starting in about 2 minutes. One more hour, live, taking on the issues that are important to you. Please stay with us. Back in 2 minutes.
Talk to me, sister, so you can see, sister.